KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Sound stories, sound voices. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. It's The Record. Seattle has a new police chief. Mayor Jenny Durkan made the announcement this morning.
I have no question that Chief Carmen Best is the person to lead the police department to the next level in the city of Seattle. She will be our next chief of police. She has earned this through hard work, dedication, and service. She will work her heart out, and I believe she will make our city proud.
Carmen Best is a 25-year veteran of Seattle Police. She'll be the first African-American woman to lead the department. But Carmen Best was not among the three finalists presented to the mayor last month after community outcry and former Pittsburgh Police Chief Cameron McLay dropping out of the race. Carmen Best was put back into the final three and today chosen to lead the Seattle Police Department. What are your thoughts? You can tweet at us at KUOW. Helping us to understand what this means for the police department and the city of Seattle, Lisa Dugard is with me in the studio. She's director of the Public Defender Association. And also on the phone, we have at-large Seattle City Council member Lorena Gonzalez. She is going to oversee the confirmation process for Carmen Best as police chief. Lorena Gonzalez, let's start with you. What do you think about the mayor's decision?
Well, thanks for having me. I think that the mayor's decision has been largely influenced by a very intensive community engagement and outreach process that has occurred over the last several weeks. And I'm happy that she had an opportunity to hear directly from community. And I'm pleased that Chief Best had an opportunity to really make the case with both the mayor and the public that she is the right choice for the city of Seattle at this point in time.
Lisa Dugard, what's your impression of the selection of Carmen Best as police chief?
I think the mayor made a great decision. I couldn't be more encouraged about where this puts us in terms of policing in Seattle in the next several years.
It's been a rather convoluted process to hiring Seattle police chiefs. Last month, the selection committee selected three finalists for the job, and Chief Best was not among the three. Do we know to what degree the committee was influenced by Mayor Durkan and the choice of those final three? Lisa Dugard.
Well, I know I serve on the Community Police Commission, but I'm not speaking on behalf of the commission here today. The process is one that the commission has been looking at going back weeks now, and I expect that they will have more to say about what unfolded and lessons that can be learned for the future. For today, I think it's really valuable to appreciate that the mayor led through a process arriving at a decision that is being widely embraced by critical sectors of our community.
But not universally embraced. Last week, we talked to lawyer, activist, and former Seattle mayoral candidate Nikita Oliver about the police chief selection. She'd been to a community meeting where all three candidates spoke. Here's what she had to say about Chief Best.
Well, she made a great case as to who she is and how she's worked in the city and how everybody knows her and a lot of people love her. Reality is the sort of reforms that need to be pushed forward in the Seattle Police Department require someone who's going to be willing to take a heavy hand. We've had 5 years of the consent decree, and yet last summer, Charlena Lyles was still murdered, and there were numerous policy violations. Carmen Best was a part of the force then, you know? And so I didn't hear anything from any of the candidates. This isn't just about Carmen, but I didn't hear anything from any of the candidates that made me think any of them were truly going to drive the sorts of reforms that are going to make communities that are targeted by police brutality safer. And that's my interest. I live in that community. I represent that community. That's what I need to hear from the next chief of police for Seattle.
Former mayoral candidate Nikita Oliver. Councilmember Gonzalez, do you agree that the reforms necessary to complete the Seattle police reform process require a heavy hand?
Well, I think it requires somebody who's going to take these issues very seriously and make them a priority. And, you know, discipline is an area where we need a lot of improvement in order to be able to deliver on the cultural change that needs to occur within the police department, within any police department, to make sure that officers understand that when they show up to work every day, they show up to work to protect and to serve and not to shoot and ask questions later. And that is a critical part of what the inquiry will be from my perspective as the chair of the Public Safety Committee to make sure that the public gets a really robust understanding of how this nominee is going to approach discipline processes, but also how this nominee is going to approach training of officers to make sure that they understand what de-escalation means and what appropriate de-escalation looks like so that we can avoid those situations in the first place.
Lisa Dugard, you're very familiar with Seattle Police from your years as a public defender. You know something about their culture. What's your response to Nikita Oliver's remark?
I was at that forum as well, and I was really struck by the comments of another panelist who is a client of my office, actually, Katrina Johnson, who is a cousin of Charlena Lyles. And she had tough questions for Chief Best about the department's response to the family on that case, and she asked them. But she commented afterwards that she thought of the candidates that Chief Best was certainly the best choice and that we can work with her. And I think that that was on full display at that forum. Chief Best is not afraid to be asked those questions, and she's very capable of engaging with strong community voices. She respects community expertise, and she's a partner in an ongoing dialogue, the end of which we none of us can clearly visualize yet. For, I think, many of us who supported Chief Best, it's not a question of perfection. I have, you know, there are instances, including with respect to the Lyles case, where I wasn't delighted with the response from the department. And it's not a question of just affection. People do feel affection for Chief Best, but it's really about, is she the leader who can engage in dialogue with people who do not always agree and take the best from that dynamic and really revolutionize policing.
Well,
and I think, yes.
She's the leader of the police department. She's been there for 25 years. The knock on her, if it's accurate, is that as someone who's been on the inside, she might have a hard time making some of the tough choices. Is there any indication, anything in her history, maybe just from the past year when she's been acting chief, where she's actually shown a willingness to kind of buck the internal culture, Lisa Dugard?
Oh, absolutely. The story of Chief Best's leadership in the department is one of her acting on principle and often taking a different road than kind of the dominant voice within the department. Some of that has been quiet and not well known publicly. But an instance that is fairly well known is the recent case of William Wingate, who the elderly gentleman with the golf club who was arrested by an officer who's since been fired. Chief Best played a really critical role in surfacing the racial bias components of that case. She doesn't hesitate to call it racist. She did everything possible to make that gentleman whole, including making sure that his golf club got returned, that charges were dismissed against him in municipal court. So I think, you know, she has been a principled leader. And the fact that she has strong support from within the department is not because she isn't a tough leader. It's because she is tough but fair, and she leads in a way that is respected even when she lands in a place that others in the department don't agree with.
City Councilmember Gonzalez, you're going to be holding hearings. You'll find out more about this. But based on what you know now, is Carmen Best, as a 25-year veteran, going to be able to stand outside the culture to make the changes necessary inside the culture?
Well, obviously, those are going to be some important questions that we're going to pose to Chief Best during the confirmation process to make sure that that we have a strong understanding of her commitment to that. But I think that she is very well poised to begin that culture change. And, you know, one of the things that I have learned in my work in this space for over 15 years is that good cops very strongly dislike bad cops. And I think that Chief Best is the type of police officer who understands that her rank and file officers want to continue to see the promotion and the advancement of good policing and good officers who understand the needs of community and understand the realities of the history and the current tenor of policing in America. And I think that she is going to be able to thread the needle there in a way that we will get a clear understanding of her vision for what culture change looks like at the police department.
Assuming that the chief is confirmed in her role, a question for each of you. We don't have that much time left, but how do we measure the success of a police chief? If a year from now, Police Chief Best has been in office for a year. How will we know she's done a good job? What will be the indicators to suggest that she's really worked out? Lorena Gonzalez?
Well, I think first and foremost for me is fulfilling the federal court's requirement to complete the sustainment period. I think that's going to be a huge indicator of how far along this chief will be able to come. We have a ways to go and a judge who has expressed frustration with our tempo, and I think that it's very clear to us that, to me, that that is going to be a big marker of success. And then secondly, I'll just add, you know, we have very significant issues in our city related to our rapid growth and how poverty is playing out on our streets every day with regard to our unsheltered population. And we need a chief who's going to be creative to help us lead on these issues so that we're not using an approach to enforce our way out of those difficult social issues, but that we have one that is focused on harm reduction approaches that still deliver on public safety.
Lisa Dugard, briefly, how will we know Carmen Best has been successful as Seattle Police Chief?
Seattle Police Department's already at the very cutting edge of policing nationally in critical areas like the approach that local police departments should take to with non-citizen, immigrant, and refugee communities, and alternative approaches to enforcement. So it's not that the police are absent, but when they do show up and they respond to law violations that stem from behavioral health issues or extreme poverty, that leads to a very different outcome than trying to jail our way out of the problem. If Chief Best fulfills her potential, the potential that I see, we will have taken those strategies to scale. SPD will have stepped away from collaboration with federal task forces and really illustrated for the rest of the country what it is to have local law enforcement set a very different approach to policing than that's being called for by the Justice Department and our federal government.
Great. We'll have it back in a year and see what your evaluation is. Lisa Dugard with us in the studio, director of the Public Defender Association, and with us on the line, Lorena Gonzalez, at-large member of the Seattle City Council. It's the record. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. Still to come, tiny houses. They put a roof over homeless people, but do they help people get out of homelessness? I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Gradke. This is The Record. $12 million. That's how much Washington spent to send 16 patients with traumatic brain injuries to a rehabilitation center in Tulsa, Oklahoma. All these patients had something in common. Their injuries led to behavior issues that were extremely hard to manage because there was nowhere to treat them in Washington state. But once those patients got to Oklahoma, there was minimal oversight of their care by state officials and no plan for when they would return home. KUOW's Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins is out with a five-part series on this story and here to talk to me about it now. Welcome, Austin.
Thanks for having me, Ross.
Of these 16 patients, they were all on Medicaid. Why did the state send them all the way to Oklahoma for treatment?
Well, you know, usually we think of government as doing requests for proposal and the government will have a need, so it will go out to contractors or vendors and ask them to propose a package, and then they'll bid that and evaluate it and decide on who to go with. This was much more organic. In fact, what happened is Brookhaven Hospital in Tulsa, Oklahoma, came to Washington's Medicaid program to ask about a particular patient who was having trouble finding a place to go. And that spawned an in-person meeting, and from there spawned a contract. And once that contract was signed, sort of opened up this pipeline, if you will, to Tulsa, and in some ways really released a relief valve where there was so much pent-up demand for this sort of service. It wasn't available in Washington, and once it was available in Oklahoma, there was suddenly a lot of people heading there.
$12 million sounds like a lot for treating 16 patients, but these are also very difficult cases. Is that just what it costs?
Well, $1,000 a day per patient in this facility, that is a hospital-level reimbursement rate. It's actually half of Brookhaven's published rate. That was what they negotiated, was $1,000 a day. By contrast, a nursing home rate would be about $80 a day. So this is by, factors of tens, much more expensive. The other kind of thing to keep in mind here is that it costs $230,000 to fly these patients from Washington State to Oklahoma aboard air ambulance flights because they were not in a condition where they could fly commercially. Now, part of why this didn't get identified as a problem for a long time is because the Medicaid program is a multi-billion dollar program. Mm-hmm. This was a very small amount compared to what Medicaid spends out. But for these few patients, this was a costly endeavor.
Most of these patients were there for months and sometimes even years. Why did these patients end up staying for so long?
In essence, what happened is that these patients slipped between the cracks of two state agencies. So Medicaid authorizes short-term hospitalizations and sent these patients to Brookhaven Hospital in Tulsa. But the healthcare authority, which runs Medicaid, is not in the business of case management. So they were getting monthly reports on these patients, but they weren't managing their cases like the Department of Social and Health Services does. But the Department of Social and Health Services ceases to do case management when someone leaves the state's borders. So once these patients were in Oklahoma, they were off the caseload of DSHS, and DSHS is responsible for long-term placements. So the only way they could come home is if DSHS was involved in finding them a long-term placement, and that wasn't happening for quite some time.
Virtually all of these people sent to Tulsa are back, as I understand it, but one has not come back. To learn more about that, I'd like to bring Katie Walker into the conversation. Welcome, Katie. Katie, are you with us? Hello, Katie.
Yes.
Thank you so much for joining us. Your mother, Lori Jenks, was in a car accident back in 2010, and suffered a traumatic brain injury. She's been in Brookhaven in Tulsa, Oklahoma for 3 years and is currently there, the last of the Washington State's patients in Tulsa. Could you tell me a little bit about your mother's condition?
Yes, she has a severe traumatic brain injury, and she's been in a variety of different facilities for the last 8 years. She has definitely some severe behavioral issues, as Austin mentioned, that made finding an appropriate placement for her very challenging. She's mostly in a wheelchair and definitely has cognitive impairments as a result of her brain injury.
When you say significant behavioral issues, what do you mean by that?
She was known to throw things, hit, spit, try to bite people if they're close. She would swear, was very verbally abusive towards her caregivers, refusing care, just really made it difficult to make sure she had the things she needed to be healthy and safe.
Katie, before your mom, Lori Jenks, went to Tulsa, you tried to get her treatment here in Washington State. Tell us what that was like.
Wasn't anything, and there still is very limited services after the initial acute phase. So right after an injury, there's hospital level of care, but they're, you know, days or weeks level of care. And we actually had her out of state earlier, right after the accident. She was in California for quite some time, and then when she returned to Washington, really struggled to find appropriate physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, the kinds of things that she needs, even just to maintain her level of functionality. Those services exist, but not specifically ones for people who have severe brain injuries with behavior issues like my mom.
And Katie, what was your hope when your mother went to Tulsa for this special treatment, and has your hopes for what that treatment would do for her played out? Has it worked?
We were really hoping for the specific neuropsych rehab that they advertise. You know, she was really struggling and really in a bad place when she went to Oklahoma, and she has calmed down some, but she's really also lost a lot of ground and really doesn't have a lot to show for the 3+ years that she's been there. I mean, her therapeutic outcomes are minimal at best. If you look back at, you know, those reports that you were mentioning from early on till now, very minimal change. She's calmer, but that also could just be that they don't aggravate her, which is our sort of assessment. They've learned how to work with her, but not really to do anything significant. So the kind of placement that she can have now after 3 years is basically the same kind of placement that would have worked for her 3 years ago.
Austin Jenkins has been reporting on this. Austin, how does the experience of Katie with her mother compare to some of the other cases that you've been looking at of these folks sent from Washington State to Tulsa, Oklahoma for treatment?
Well, it's very similar. And so before we talk about Brookhaven, I'll just talk generally about the fact that as I've done this reporting, I have been told repeatedly and over again that no two brain injuries are alike. So that's just a starting point. Brain injury as a subspecialty in medicine is still relatively new. We started hearing a lot more about it in the wake of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, but it's still the lack of resources for families and just the devastation when somebody's personality changes so dramatically. I mean, Katie's dad described Lori as the social, the person who kind of was the social coordinator for their family. She showed dogs. She showed Weimaraners and was very active on that circuit and well known. And to think that in an instant, the person you know, the mom or the wife or the sibling you know, is changed dramatically and forever has been very hard for these families. And then at Brookhaven, you know, it was wrenching for these families to send their loved ones 2,000 miles away. They did it because they thought this was the best answer for the moment. I don't think any of them anticipated it would last for years. And the idea that there was no plan to bring them home is what most of the families that I've spoken with have said is so frustrating and, frankly, for them, unacceptable in the end.
Katie's mom is the last one in Tulsa from Washington State. What happened to the other 15 who left there?
So there were 16 in all, 11 who stayed the longest. Five were able to come back and essentially go back home. At last check, there are actually three still there. And Lori Jenks, Katie's mom, is one of them. And part of why she's still there is because the family is holding out for a better option, if you will, than what the state has offered. The state offered her a placement in an adult family home in Spokane. I know that Katie's dad is not thought that that was the right placement. She may want to elaborate a little bit on this, but they are holding out possibly for a placement on the East Coast where Katie's based.
Yeah, Katie, how about that? You live in Massachusetts. Your mom is now in Tulsa. What would you like to see with your mother?
I think what we hope for is specialized care for her. As Austin said, no two brain injuries are the same, but also brain injury comes with its own, there are some sort of generalizations and some things that are very specific in terms of caring for a brain injured patient, and a lot of the care systems that are set up are really meant for dealing with older, elderly patients who really are in decline and sort of about placating them, and a brain injury patient really needs to be pushed in order to maintain or even improve. And there's a lot of other things in terms of, you know, similarities to dementia, but not the same, or Alzheimer's. And a lot of the care that's out there is not really specialized for brain injury. So that's our hope, is to find a place that knows really how to address the needs of a brain injured patient, so that she can live life that she has. You know, as Austin said, she wasn't really expected to live. It's, you know, it's the fact that she's here with us is a blessing, but there's definitely a lot of challenges, and hoping to find some place that really can take those into consideration when they're caring for her.
Katie Walker, her mother, is a patient with a traumatic brain injury at the Brookhaven Rehabilitation Center in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where she was sent from Washington State. Washington State has spent $12 million sending 16 brain injury patients there. Also, KUOW's Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins with us. There's a five-part series with much more detail on this story. You can hear it each day this week during Morning Edition here on KUOW. Austin and Katie, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Up ahead, a classic novel of sailing in the Northwest, Jim Lynch's Before the Wind. I'm Ross Reynolds, in for Bill Radke. It's The Record. I'm Ross Reynolds, in for Bill Radke. Last week, Seattle opened its eighth tiny house community in Whittier Heights. The village will be the first to exclusively serve women. The aim of these villages is to shelter people who are homeless and to provide security and stability. But not everyone sees the 100-square-foot buildings as the best solution for Seattle's homelessness. The city is currently being sued over a tiny house village planned for the South Lake Union neighborhood, And the Seattle Times investigation out today found that at the Wallingford site, there was no cache management for more than 3 months. Also, it took weeks for the camp to get electricity and a hygiene truck. Well, the city of Seattle calls these issues growing pains. But Record host Bill Radke recently sat down with someone who disagrees, co-chair of the grassroots organization Speak Out Seattle, Elizabeth James. He was also joined by the executive director of the Low Income Housing Institute, Sharon Lee. Her group owns and operates Seattle's tiny house villages. They spoke before the Seattle Times investigation was released, and Bill began the conversation by having Lee describe the idea behind the villages.
So many people are trying to survive, like literally survive, in a cardboard box or in a cold, wet tent on the street. And it's not, you know, these tents are not made for year-round use. There's wind, there's rain. It's untenable to be sleeping in a tent or to feel safe. So the tiny house is a short-term crisis response, and we're clear about that. This is not a long-term solution. Until we build more affordable housing, we need safe places for people. And the tiny houses have evolved so that they are now, all of them are insulated. They have heat, electricity. They have an outlet so people can charge their phone. And they have access to toilets, showers, laundry, a fully equipped staff kitchen, community space, often Wi-Fi. So there's a whole community around the tiny house that supports the people so that they feel safe.
Elizabeth, everything has pros and cons. Mm-hmm. Before we get to the cons, do you agree that there are positives about people having a locked door and heating and sanitation and that solid home?
It's better than tents. Yes, I do agree that it's better than tents. I thought tents were just a horrible idea. I think that we should aim higher, though. I don't think that this is a great temporary solution, even.
Why is that?
Because it's a waste of resources, and the sense that we're not putting that urgency and all that time that these meetings take place in order to renew permits or get permits or talk to neighborhoods, all of that should be, that laser focus should be on working with businesses, residents, you know, nonprofits, churches, and the government, pulling everybody together and having real solutions that are permanent that involve mixed use to housing, not clumping one group of people together in substandard third world conditions and saying, this is okay for now for you.
Why not tiny house villages for now until we have the permanent solutions? You talked about resources. Why not both?
Well, I think one of the things is that the tiny house villages have had issues in the neighborhoods that where they're located. The Licton Springs one, we didn't oppose it, but we did have suggestions for how it could be improved.
That's the tiny house village between like Greenwood and Maple Leaf. It's a low barrier shelter, so that in Licton Springs, people can use alcohol or drugs.
And we did have suggestions that it could be improved, because if you put a whole group of people, at that point they were talking 70 people, you know, that have various issues, whether it's behavioral health, mental health, the criminal history, or drug use, or an alcoholist, and then you put that into right across the street from a neighborhood and a school, you know, a few hundred feet away, you could anticipate that there might be some issues.
Well, let's talk about that. We have, Sharon, we have some tape here from the meeting to re-permit. Someone who lives in the area, Jim Sullivan, prefaced his statements by saying he has empathy for the situation. This is helping people, but he has seen an increase in crime.
Our crime rate has increased tenfold. Car prowls, assaults, drug activity, needles. Not only car prowls, but going into people's garages, going into people's homes, going into their yards. And one, which I can't substantiate, but it was reported, even assaulted with a gun as she was getting off the bus, walking to her home.
Sharon, how do you respond to that?
Well, I think Licton Springs is in a neighborhood already, if you look at Aurora Avenue, and that neighborhood has had a prevalence of crime and incidents that's much higher than other neighborhoods, regardless of whether Licton Springs Tiny House Village is there or not. So the majority of the tiny house villages are clean and sober and do not allow alcohol and drug use on site. And so those are very, very different this was a, I have to say, this was a sort of a trial to see if this could work. And so we are at Licton Springs working on a plan that would include more security lighting, cameras, staffing issues. And, you know, and we're working closely with the community. We have a community advisory committee. I will say this, is that we have looked at other tiny house villages, like the one at Othello Village, and crime has decreased 29% to 30% in that village. And the neighbors are very supportive, and the neighbors are very
Since the village first opened? Or
yes.
What, crime?
Yeah, yes, okay. Absolutely. We have police data that shows that. The information around Licton Springs, the police data is not like fine-tuned yet, so we don't really know how much is related to the village and how much is related to what's happening around the neighborhood regardless of the village. I will say in terms of data, we actually have information that the city and Low-Income Housing Institute, our case managers, have collected that shows clearly that if you're in a tiny house, it is a very effective strategy to move you into long-term housing. So we have moved over 300 people into permanent long-term housing, and we have reunited 80 people with their families or friends so that they're no longer on the streets. And then we've had over 200 people, because they live in a tiny house, you know, they can lock the door, they can change, they have a shower, they can go to work. So we have over 200 people have employment by virtue of the fact that they're living in a tiny house.
Regarding successful outcomes, my understanding is to continue receiving funding. King County has a minimum standard, an exit rate of 40%. These are King County numbers that from April 1st of 2017 through March 31st, 2018, Ballard Tiny Home Village, 13% exits to permanent housing, 20% return to homelessness. Georgetown, 20% exits to permanent housing, 17% return to homelessness. And are we diverting resources to allow people to live in these small places and not channeling money into what we would call low-income housing?
Well, I think everyone should be aware of the fact that in order to build one low-income housing unit, one apartment costs $300,000. To set up a tiny house village costs $300,000. So you could house one person in one apartment, and it takes 4 years to build that building. I'm not saying that's not important. We do that all the time. We want more permanent and affordable housing, but it can't be built quickly enough. Whereas a tiny house village, we can house 60 people, set it up, and have staff there, and then quickly move people into housing. Now, the average area rent for Seattle for a two-bedroom is now $2,800. And so it is very, very difficult for people who are exiting homelessness to get into market rate housing. So I challenge Elizabeth and others, you know, to advocate for more affordable housing.
Elizabeth, what about the idea that tiny house villages are economically are bang for the buck?
You know, if the rate of moving out and into productive lives in independence was moving faster, I think that that it would be more of a solution. But we've had encampments in Seattle since the 1990s, and we're just getting more homeless. We're getting more people that choose to live out on the street. And there are many people, when they go to the council meetings, who have been homeless for 10 or more years now. We need to come up with a better, quit calling this a temporary solution if we've been doing it since 1990, and start looking at how we should really address this and what are the causes that lead someone into homelessness. It's not just a loss of a job.
The proposed tiny house village in South Lake Union would not be a low barrier, my understanding. Is that right? It would not be a low barrier village?
The way that Tiffany Washington of the Human Services Department stated that it would be is that you couldn't use any drugs or alcohol in the common areas of the encampment, but you could go ahead and do any drugs or alcohol inside your unit.
Well, I can do drugs and alcohol in my right. home. So what's the important difference?
I think
there?
The difference is that you're moving in a community, a brand new group of people to this neighborhood. A lot of times when they do this, the navigation team takes people from all over the city and brings them into one little concentrated area. And even if they're behaving well, it does tend to attract other encampments springing up around but the nearby, and there is an increase in crime reported by neighbors. One of the things I know in North Seattle and Ballard was that we just couldn't get a police officer to respond.
Well, then is the issue then not with tiny house villages, but with more enforcement of
That would be a safe thing. And that's one of the recommendations that our group had made about the tiny villages, that you could anticipate when you have people that are using illegal substances, that they're going to have to get the drugs from somewhere, and that maybe some drug dealers would come to the property.
Would you acknowledge, Sharon, that tiny house villages have to go someplace? So what do you do with the problem of the concerns of the neighbors around a tiny house village site?
Well, I think we are seeing a lot of support from neighbors. So when we build the tiny houses or, paint the tiny houses or collect donations, we have overwhelming support from direct neighbors, church groups, businesses. So the residents around Othello Village are very supportive and would like it to stay. The village around Inner Bay, they wanted the village to stay, and they're continuing to provide support and bring food and bring donations to the Inner Bay site.
Is that something we agree on, Elizabeth, that some neighborhoods find success?
I agree that some neighbors in neighborhoods support the tiny house concept. I live in Ballard, so when they proposed the small encampment that in my neighborhood, which was not very far from me, I did not oppose it. I was a wait and see. I didn't have a problem until all of a sudden there was encampments within half a mile of it all over the place.
What kind of encampments?
You mean, unauthorized ones.
So are you saying one caused the other, that the tiny house village
attracted? We know that some of the people at the Locks Hillside lost six trees, full-size trees, went sliding down the hillside from an encampment up there. I talked to people up there several times who admitted that they came and were kicked out for behavior or whatever, and they just moved, six blocks away and set up in another area. I believe the Tiny House Village and the City of Seattle both have, the responsibility to make sure that impacts on the neighborhood, that they look beyond the block around them and say, if we're having people exit, let's make sure we work with the navigation team and that these people aren't just leaving and taking out their anger about being kicked out on the neighborhood.
Would that make tiny house villages okay with you if the follow-up were there?
I still go back to, I think that they're ultimately a waste of time. I wouldn't say close them right now. I would say quit adding more and let's really get down to how can we do this together as a city where everybody feels good about it, and that the Business Journal says we're spending $1 billion a year on homelessness in Seattle, King County. We would like to see something for that $1 billion.
Let's talk about whether tiny house villages are an appropriate place for people to live. A consultant to the City of Seattle on homelessness, here she is, Barbara Poppy, talking with King 5 in 2017, calling tiny house villages shanty towns.
What is the difference between those and refugee camps? Well, in many circumstances, the refugee camps are a higher standard. I just find it very unsettling. And I look at those spaces and I think, what would it take for your community to rapidly deploy the resources and actually construct some apartments there?
What do you think, Sharon, of her comparison to refugee camps?
I think it's insulting and it's not true, because if you're in a refugee camp, you are more or less a prisoner and you're living in abject poverty and you can be starving to death. This is not the case at all in a tiny house village. So it's like ridiculous.
I disagree with that. I think that Barb Poppy and the USICH, which is the United U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness, they actually recommend against doing encampments, even ones that are these tiny sheds that are having. And the reason why is because they've statistically done this across the United States, and they say they do not have good outcomes for actually leading people out of homelessness. You know, the USICH came out with a report in May that said that these are difficult to manage and maintain, and that they are targets for illegal activity, that they tend to not be temporary, which is shown here. We started out in 2015, adding just a few in the city, and now we're up to 8. And I've heard at meetings that the goal is to have 12 by the end of the year. They are also moving to remove the time limit restriction from 2 years maximum. And I just believe that, you know, like the Poppy Report and like the USICH, these funds could be targeted more strategically to build permanent housing.
We are showing a much higher rate of success than shelters, but you're not attacking shelters, or enhanced shelters, and you're not attacking enhanced shelters. So I'm just saying that the reason why there's a city evaluation that said that tiny house villages are more effective than other forms of shelter, and you should read that document.
Sharon, tiny house villages, is that the is it becoming the standard that we're setting as a city? Are you troubled that the city is saying, in effect, this is the best we can do with a more stable village than a homeless encampment, but this is the answer? Does that concern you?
Well, we think permanent low-income affordable housing is the way to go, but we can't wait for it to happen. We can't wait for, you know, 5 or 10,000 units to get built overnight. It's not going to happen. So in the meantime, we think it is the solution. We have a lot of people who have been spending years living in the park or living on the streets. And so if we can get them out of their tent into a tiny house village and into permanent housing, that's the way to go.
Sharon Lee, Executive Director of the Low Income Housing Institute, with Elizabeth James, co-chair of Speak Out Seattle. They were talking to Bill Radke about tiny house villages in Seattle. You're listening to The Record on KUOW, Sound Stories, Sound Voices. Hey, it's still The Record. I'm Ross Reynolds, in for Bill Radke. We're surrounded by water here. Sailing is a core aspect of living here. It used to be how we got around. Today, it's a pleasure culture. Some of us own boats, many others work on boats or rent boats. The rest of us just watch them sail in Lake Washington, Puget Sound, or pass through the Ballard Locks. Olympia writer Jim Lynch wrote a classic novel about sailing culture in the Northwest called Before the Wind. It's about the Johansons, a family that works on boats and loves them, even though they don't always love the boat's owners. I spoke to Jim Lynch about his novel, Before the Wind, shortly after it was published, back in May of 2016. To me, I haven't spent that much time on the water, but to me, it really captures some of the allure of it. And in fact, there's a section of the book where the mother of the Johansson clan, which is the focus of this book, answers the question, why do we feel so good out here on the water? And I wanted to begin with having you read that section.
Okay, sure. Mother loved these sorts of questions. Why do we laugh when something is funny? Why do we dream of flying? Well, it's the same feeling we get when we walk along the ocean, isn't it? She began, indirectly, as usual. It's that ionic lift from salty water, sure, but it's more than that, isn't it? We were all saying yes and nodding and listening hard in case she put her finger on something revelatory. And it's even more powerful when you're out on the water all day because the rise and fall of the ocean connects you to the sun and the moon, right? With her eyes squeezed shut, we knew not to rush her. That alone might make us feel good, but let's not forget we live on a planet that's mostly water, and so are we, right? We were too tired to respond. Sure, whatever, yes. And we know all of life began in salty water, so maybe the reason we feel like we're glowing or buzzing at times like these is that when we're out here, every cell in our body is saying, Mama! After a thoughtful lull, Ruby broke the silence by shouting, Mama!
So that's how you describe the sensation of being on the water and why it might be so mystical. How would you describe it personally? How do you feel when you're sailing?
Well, for me, it kind of connects me to my childhood. Is one of my first reflexes. I think part of it was that when I was a kid, my dad was always in the best mood when we were on water, and so I think that was kind of the first communication to me that this was, you know, something to be revered, and it just kind of stuck with me. I like the challenge of it, and I love the lulls too. I was so happy when I was researching the book to find out that Albert Einstein was a lifelong sailor, loved to sail, and there aren't that many written words about actually, you know, what kind of sailor he was and so on. But I poured over everything there was, and it appeared that he particularly liked to be out in lulls when there was no wind, and he could drift around and scribble down his ideas. And the fact that he also just loved it as the ultimate escape, you know, that back then without cell phones, of course, that he could get away from his students and his peers and the media and his family and just think.
Did you write any of Before the Wind or scribble notes for it while you were sailing?
Well, I'm usually someone in charge of the sailing, but I wrote a lot on the boat. And I actually ended up the final draft of this novel I wrote using my boat as an office. I would get up in the morning, I would go down to the marina, and I'd crawl on board. And nobody knew I was there. I didn't have Wi-Fi. And then I had the smell and the atmosphere of a sailboat. And that's actually when it all started to take off for me. There's a certain moment whenever I'm writing a book where I keep waiting for it to finally lift off and for the characters to feel as real as my friends and family. And that's where it happened, was actually on the boat, which all made me feel justified in buying the boat, of course.
Well, there's the beauty and the allure of sailing. And then there's the gritty reality of building and maintaining sailboats. You write that running a boatyard is like running a dementia clinic. How so?
The point I was getting at is just that I watched all these guys that work in boatyards, men and women, and they're constantly having to counsel the boat owners and make them feel all right about the fact that they're spending far more on their boat than they can afford, or that they basically should give up on this boat and go find another boat. But there's all this kind of delusion that boat owners have about their boats. They get so attached to them that they fail to realize that their boat is ordinary or worse or needs a lot of work. They get a very sentimental relationship to the boat, and it often it's like telling somebody that you need to put their dog down. You know, it's an unusual.
But even the experienced sailors who know better and maybe don't have more money than they have intelligence about it, which some of the novices experience, they have this love affair with their boats.
Right. Well, I grew up the son of a father who had love affairs with boats, and we used to walk the docks down around Shilshil and all, and he told me what gorgeous sailboats were, you know, and he had all the drawings at home. He was considering making them and so on. So I had a role model on kind of the sailing obsession in my father.
As a boat owner, what do you think of the old saying, happiest two moments in a boat owner's life are the day they buy the boat and the day they sell the boat?
Well, I guess I'm more sentimental about my boats. I sold a boat that I'd had for 10 years, and I felt almost weepy leaving it. So there's been boats I've been happy to sell. But I think you can also generate a lot of affection for them. And then when you see them, and so I've sailed past my old boat with my new boat, because my old boat's still in Olympia, and I'm so happy that it's in the hands of some guy who takes really good care of it, and he polishes, you know, he oils all the wood, and the boat just looks great. But I'm now going past him in my bigger, faster dream boat, and so
the old girlfriend.
Yeah, it is the old girlfriend phenomenon. Yeah.
Jim Lynch is with us. He's from Olympia. And his latest novel is called Before the Wind, about sailing, about a sailing family. Your book is set in so many familiar places. The Johansson family's first shipyard is on the Ship Canal here in Seattle. The mother teaches at Ballard High School. The scenes of sailing are on Puget Sound. What was the picture you wanted to reveal about our region's boat culture?
I wanted to try to get across the richness and the fascination that I have with this boating culture. I think it's a big chunk of the way we are here. I mean, with Lake Washington and Puget Sound, we have a geography that's unlike just about anywhere else. And Puget Sound, stretching up into the San Juans and into Canada, this whole inland sea is considered one of the great boating wonderlands of the world. And yet, I think those of us that don't actually get out on boats, for them, it's more a part of the scenery. But I think it's actually kind of inherent in our whole culture and style of people that we have out here. You know, we have the mountaineering crowd, you know, we have the downhill skiing crowd, and we have your boating crowd, and they create a certain kind of personality, a certain kind of person, in my opinion. If you spend enough time on the water, you get a certain confidence about your own ability to survive in awkward predicaments, because you run into them out there, and you also have just a different vantage on where it is that we live, because when you're just seeing this area from the land, you're kind of missing one of the main angles of it. And one of the things that's always fascinated me is just that you go through the ship canal, you go through the locks, and it's almost like you enter the rest of the world because suddenly you're in salt water, and from there you can go anywhere. And I just remember being kind of dazzled by that as a kid, that the whole world opened up.
There's so much anxiety, particularly in Seattle, about the wealth that's coming here, the tech people who are coming here, and the concern that kind of the things that make this place special are going away because of it. Do you think there's any threat to that when it comes to boating culture, when it comes to kind of the hardscrabble families like the Johansson that are basically getting by?
I think there is reason to be concerned about that, and that's also kind of part of why I like setting a big chunk of the novel down in Olympia, because Olympia is maybe economically and so on kind of like Seattle was 30, 40 years ago, in that the houses cost half as much and the boating culture down there is far more affordable. And it's kind of a peaceful old Puget Sound. There's no freighters, there's no ferry boat waves, and yet we've got our own kind of boating mecca down there as well. And I think that it has changed pretty dramatically since when I was a kid, when we used to go up into the San Juan Islands, and now all the boats are considerably larger. You know, the average size of a boat is considerably larger. And you go farther up into Canada, up into Desolation Sound, and then it's just kind of yachts, and then a few hard scrabble boats mixed in. Yeah, it's definitely changing.
And indeed, the Johansson family starts out on the ship canal here in Seattle, and there have been some tensions about the working waterfront and working things along there with the competition from others who'd like to use that waterfront for other reasons. And the son ends up at a shipyard down in Olympia. Is there a nod here to kind of the pressures which have been on working class businesses along the ship canal and places like that?
I have kind of a nostalgic love of the older ship canal. And I love the ship canal. I just think it's such a intriguing body of water to pass through. I like it being a working waterfront. I like the fact that you still have the fishing boats down in Ballard and fishing vessels kind of lodged together as these rusting edifices downtown. I don't want it to see it become a waterfront of luxury yachts.
Olympia writer Jim Lynch talking about his novel Before the Wind. That was recorded in May of 2016. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Ross Reynolds, in for Bill Radke. The record produced by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jima Brempong, Allison Bruzek, Matt Martin, Sophie Reed, and Jason Pagano. Our social media producer is Kara McDermott. Bernard Ouellette is in control.